The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
America Now, there are reports of an explosion at the Pentagon being passed over Fox News. Additional reports of airplanes crashing on the 395 in Washington, D.C., the White House being evacuated. Of course, the president is not in Washington, D.C. at this point. Obviously, the nation going to high and full alert as it is under attack in many places in an extraordinary coordination of assaults on the most visible landmarks in the country. Thousands of people trapped inside burning towers in lower Manhattan. Obvious prayers for that.
That was 20 years ago, America. Good morning. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Morning glory to everyone. 20 years ago, I was on the air on the West Coast from 6 to 9 in the morning, which meant during the attacks. I'll play parts of that for you in the show ahead. But first, I'm joined from Afghanistan by Susanna George of the Washington Post. 20 years later, as we look back at 9/11, I could not believe that we would be where we are in Afghanistan today. Good morning, Susanna. Welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning.
Where are you? Can you tell us where you are in Kabul?
I'm in central Kabul, which has been the scene over the past week or so of protests, many led by women demanding their rights and pushing back against Taliban rule in the country.
Now, you chose to stay even when Fred Ryan exited most of the Post staff. Are you supported by a large staff of friendly Afghans? Or are they keeping you safe?
I'm working with great people. I obviously miss my colleagues very, very much, especially at this point in time, this really important time in Afghanistan's history. We had worked together really closely over the past 2 years, and it feels very lonely to be back in Afghanistan without them, I have to say.
Well, I salute your courage for remaining and giving us eyewitness accounts every day. Thank you very much for that. Susanna, do you have a minimum number of American passport holders that you know want to get out of the country?
I don't have that number. I know anecdotally of some people who are American passport holders who are still trying to get out of the country. And it appears that these efforts are back up and running, possibly on a daily basis. They're not being called evacuation flights, but yesterday, some 200 dual nationals, these are Afghans who held American passports as well as Afghan passports. There are also people who held British passports among the group, were able to leave the country on a chartered flight yesterday. And today, I believe that there are plans for a similar flight. The Qataris who I've spoken to who are helping organize this effort say they hope that this is going to become a regular occurrence and that international commercial flights will start up in just a few days, and these chartered planes won't be necessary anymore.
To me, the key thing is those who have an American passport, whether or not they can leave easily. That hasn't been the case until yesterday when some did get out. And I don't try and categorize people as LPRs or dual national. I just want to know if they've got an American passport. Can they get out? Do you know of any American passport holders who are afraid to come out into the streets and are avoiding contact with anyone?
Yeah, I know a lot of people who are too scared to leave their homes right now. I know that there are some people who are, on this list to be evacuated who are not getting the right information from the State Department, who've been waiting for weeks now to get the green light to come to a certain place. Where they can then board buses and go to the airport in a secure convoy that's coordinated with the Taliban so that they have safe passage. And, I know a lot of people who are on those lists, but they're too scared to leave their homes without 100% assurance that they will be quickly moved out of the country after leaving their homes, because just stepping out onto the street, they feel like it's too big of a risk right now.
Not surprisingly, Susanna, you've zeroed in on what to me is the major question. I watch people at podiums say that we have lists and we're in constant contact with a handful of Americans, Jen Psaki said yesterday. I don't think that's a handful. I don't think they're in contact with everyone. What is your degree of confidence of states' full grasp of the situation of the Americans who hold passports on the ground in Kabul and throughout the country, by the way, Herat, Kandahar, et cetera?
What I can tell you is that from the people who I've spoken to, and again, you know, this is anecdotal evidence. I have not spoken to every single American passport holder who's still in Afghanistan. From what I've heard from speaking to people is that it's really hit or miss. Some people have, you know, they'll receive a call, but the information will be incomplete about where to go. Other people haven't received a call at all, even though they've submitted all of their information and supposedly are on a list. From what I've heard, it does not sound like a very well-oiled machine. But what I do know is that these continued efforts to get Americans out of the country are ongoing. They are getting a lot of attention from officials in Washington, D.C., all the way up to the highest levels, and they remain a top priority. The execution has just not been what a lot of people had hoped.
Are you aware of anyone who's been abducted or disappeared who's an American passport holder?
That I'm not aware of specifically, but there have been a series of abductions, of targeted killings, of house-to-house searches. These especially have spiked since these protests have sprung up in Kabul. After the protests became violent, one of the ways that protesters say that the Taliban have pushed back against the demonstrations is by targeting protesters and the neighborhoods that they come from with house-to-house searches.
Susanna George is with the Washington Post. She's in Kabul. Susanna, do you hear of Americans who are in Herat, Kandahar, Mazar-e-Sharif? Are there Americans spread across the country still, or have most of them, to your knowledge, gotten to Kabul?
I actually do not have that information in front of me.
Okay. What is your daily life like, Susanna?
Full of a lot of work. We're very busy, and we spend a lot of our time talking to Taliban officials, as well as talking to Afghans about the change that their country is going through and has gone through over the past few weeks. Right now, we have incredible freedom of movement. We're able to move around the city very easily if we are stopped at checkpoints. It just takes a quick look at my press badge and we're waved through. And luckily, because I have been working here for a few years before the Taliban took over, I have a network of contacts of Afghans who are not comfortable enough to be out on the street. But when we do go out on the street, there are markets. People are walking around buying goods. The economy is almost 100% stagnant at the moment because of the freezes on Afghanistan's reserves that the United States has imposed. But there are people out and about. And when we talk to people who are out and about, they say that, so far so good, but they still feel like they're in a bit of a wait-and-see mode. They're still waiting to see whether or not the Taliban are going to continue to rule with the types of rules that they've imposed so far, or if it's going to become more stringent.
And that leads me to my last two questions. The ability to function well, that means food, water, and necessities, plus the condition of women generally. Are they back under burqas? How much has changed in those two categories, Susanna George?
I can tell you that Kabul, and again, it's frustrating for me because I haven't really been able to travel outside of problem, not because of any Taliban restrictions, just because of our own security concerns. But I've spent a lot of time in Kabul over the past few weeks, and the city as a whole is quieter, but there are still a lot of women walking around on the street, not in burqas, in hijabs, so like with a headscarf and a long gown, but still wearing bright colors. When I talk to shop owners, they say that more and more women are buying darker colored clothing. That's something that a lot of shop owners have told me. But there has not been this overnight shift to every woman wearing a burqa or every woman wearing a black abaya in Kabul. You have not seen that. That was something that we all thought that we might see once the Taliban came into town.
Susanna George from The Washington Post, please keep in touch with us. Stay safe and continue your great reporting. The Afghanistan-Pakistan Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Follow her on Twitter at SG Reports. SG Reports. Thank you, Susanna. I'll be right back, America, on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin and Resveratrol Omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. 20 years ago, the country was, well, just shocked. I've been playing that for you. But the great triumph over the panic of that day is tomorrow, when millions of Americans play and go to college football. We've been through riots. We've been through pandemics. We've been through disasters and recessions. But 20 years after 9/11, we're playing college football, and I'm joined by Doug Lemarise, who is with Cleveland.com. He's the host of the College Football Playoff Podcast. Good morning, Doug. How are you?
I'm doing great, Hugh. Thanks for having me on.
Doug, what were you doing 20 years ago?
I was in an airport in Philadelphia, and I was getting on a plane right as everything was happening. I can remember getting ready to get on the plane and seeing something about a burning building on a TV in the airport. And getting on and thinking, I wonder what's going on with that. And so I was there on the East Coast, you know, on very similar flights where that ended so tragically. So, yeah, that was right in the heart of that.
Were you able to take off, or did you end up driving wherever you were going?
Did not take off. I was a baseball beat writer at the time covering the Philadelphia Phillies, getting ready to fly to Atlanta for a baseball series. Some of the other writers were in the air when it happened on a flight that it left slightly earlier. I did not take off, but then I started reporting and walking around the airport and asking people about what was happening and ended up telling a lot of people about what was happening. I know for some people, they found out because some reporter in an airport walked up to them and said, "Do you know what's happening? It's the modern day Pearl Harbor." And so, that was
very similar to my experience. I was on the air doing 3 hours live. But what was interesting, Sports Illustrated the next week had the cover the day the sports stopped. 20 years later, we're not stopped. We're back and we're playing. Part of that is your new College Football Playoff podcast, which I listened to religiously. And I'm not going to stop with this regular segment. And, you know, Steve Kornacki's coming up after you to do his regular segment. Tell us, first of all, again, put aside 20 years ago, given where your rankings are, and you do them every week, what are the most important game that happened last week, Doug, that people were watching?
Yeah, you can have games this early that matter for the playoff, Hugh, which is why we talk about the playoff all the time. I thought Clemson, Georgia, a top five matchup last week, did matter for the playoff. Defensive struggle, two great defenses. Georgia got an interception return for a touchdown, won that game. Clemson has dominated its conference in the ACC. Clemson has made it 6 of the 7 years in the playoff, but losing that game, I think there's a chance, even if Clemson runs the table and doesn't lose again, it's possible that loss could keep them out of the playoff. It was that big of a deal. That was a big win for Georgia, which has been in the playoff one time, but lives in the shadow of Alabama. Georgia looked legit last
week. You and Shahan spent, you were trying not to be too dismissive of the Clemson quarterback with the unpronounceable name for me, but you were nevertheless somewhat suspicious of him at the end of that game.
Yeah. the big three teams in college football, Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, all starting second-year guys who have never been full-time starters before. And DJ Uiagalelei had some young moments, right? They're young. They've never done this. But in this world, one rough game can trip up your season.
You also host Buckeye Podcast, which is one of my four podcasts that I listen to religiously. Doug is on three of them. The fourth comes from a competitor over at the Athletic Cleveland. But on the Buckeye Podcast, you're very generous to C.J. Stroud. Good for you. But we're going to find out a lot in the game ahead. What's the most important game this weekend? I think I know what you're going to say.
You know, Ohio State-Oregon is up there, Hugh, but Oregon might not have its best defensive player. Kayvon Thibodeau might be the best defensive player in America. He sprained his ankle last week. He's a pass rusher, will get after C.J. Stroud. We're not sure he's going to play. I actually feel very political here. The biggest football game in the country this week is in Iowa. It's Iowa State, Iowa, in Ames. Those are two, I think, legitimate top 10 caliber teams. It's the 68th meeting of those teams in that Cy-Hawk rivalry. It is the biggest game in the history of the Iowa State-Iowa rivalry. It has playoff implications.
Iowa affiliates are jumping up and down with joy that someone has said their game matters more than a Buckeye game.
Yeah, I'm telling you, man. I mean, listen, right? I'm in Ohio. If it was Ohio, I'd say Ohio. I can't believe how excited I am for this game in Ames at 4:30 on Saturday. Two very similar teams, great defenses, great running backs. They are kind of underdog programs. They don't have Alabama's talent, but they have great coaching, and it really matters. It really does.
Well, you know, these early games, and we got about a minute left, Doug. These early games should not matter this much. At least it never used to be set up. We'd go and play, Palookas, wherever they were. But now I gather it's in college football's interest to make it interesting every weekend.
TV's interest to make it interesting every weekend. It's good for the fans, though, too, right? They sprinkle the Palookas in a little bit more now. But there's no preseason in college football like in the NFL. So you don't get a chance to really work it out, especially with these young quarterbacks. You get in there and you got to go. Ohio State, C.J. Stroud, they played Minnesota last week. Minnesota's a solid team. So we had a rough first half. He got it back in the second half. But, yeah, they could actually use a preseason, I think, right? Because we all need a little warm-up. I needed a warm-up this morning, Hugh.
But yeah, I got to sing opera every morning. Here's the deal. Go Google College Football Playoff Podcast. Doug Lesmeries and his buddy Shahan are on there every week. They do two podcasts a week. It's one of my must-listen to if you want to be ready for the college football world this weekend on the 20th anniversary of a nightmare. You want to have a good daydream. It's the College Football Playoff Podcast. Doug, thank you. Talk to you next week. I'll be right back. America, hour number two of this Friday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show, straight ahead.
Secret notebook of Nikola Tesla with his most dangerous formulas could fall into the hands of evolutionary elite scientists.
His most amazing discoveries thought to be written in a lost journal. The right hands, it could revolutionize the 21st century.
They want to start a new world order where elites rule and everyday people are not created equal.
Look out!
Now the elites plan to set off an earthquake under LA to take out world leaders.
There's an old brown battered notebook in my office at work. You have to find it, take it, and keep it hidden at all costs.
Let's just say there are a lot of enemies of the state interested in his research.
It's up to regular people to stop them. A grad student, a campus cop, a deaf army vet, and a group of live action role players.
A vertical quake this size could collapse half of Dontop.
Catch Final Frequency, playing exclusively on SalemNow.com or download the mobile app. For more information, visit FinalFrequencyFilm.com.
Morning, Glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Say a prayer for the Americans held hostage in Afghanistan. I began today's show by talking with Susanna George, the Washington Post correspondent in Kabul, who confirmed we just don't really know how many Americans there are in Afghanistan. Many are afraid to come out. Many are in contact with the State Department. We just don't know, and we'll continue to follow that story. I also spent most of the first hour replaying some clips from my show 20 years ago when I was on live, when the planes struck the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the field outside of Pittsburgh. I'm joined now by Steve Kornacki, Steve is 42, so he was just out of college when the attack on America began. Steve, where were you 20 years ago tomorrow?
Yeah, Hugh, I was listening. That obviously brought back, as I'm sure it does for everybody out there, a lot of memories and a lot of unpleasant memories, obviously, and a lot of feelings. I was driving across the country. I had just graduated college. I was driving across the country with a couple friends from Boston to L.A., and we had just crossed over into Ohio. And, you know, in those days, most people didn't have cell phones, didn't get the phone alerts. And I remember we were listening to a CD in the car, and we turned it off and just happened to have whatever radio station was on come on. And you just start picking up these reports from, you know, the World Trade Center and, you know, sitting there thinking, is this some kind of like War of the Worlds hoax? And then it just kind of sunk in, and we just, you know, we got off the highway. And we ended up staying for the week in a, I'm sure you know it, Worcester, Ohio.
Oh, sure. Home of Worcester College.
Yep. We got off the highway, just drove till we got somewhere, and Worcester was where we landed, and that's where we stayed for a week. So that's, and I took it all in.
Smart move. You may have, if you were close to Worcester, been listening to me. I was on 9 to noon in the East in those days and broadcasted live for 3 hours, came back for 2 hours, and did my TV show that night. And it was a stunning information flow, but I took it in like you would today. You try and stick to the facts, but I got some things wrong. I thought 50,000 people were dead in the World Trade Center. Where were you going, Steve? Were you beginning a career in broadcast? Did your life change because of 9/11?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it. You know, it changed. You know, and I had a couple friends that I was trying to land a job in the media, and I had two friends who were trying to make it. You know, they were film students at Boston University. They wanted to make it in, you know, in L.A., you know, writing scripts, writing movies. And they were heading out there. And I had told them, you know what, I don't have a job lined up yet. I'll go with you. You know, I've always wanted to drive across the country. I'll take the drive. You know, I'll see what it's like out there. I'll probably come back myself. That was my plan. So I ended up staying out there, you know, for a few months with them. And, came back and grew up and got serious about my life.
Well, that's about an 11-hour drive from Boston to Worcester, because you're doing it in June or you're doing it in September. So it's about 11 hours. The roads are okay. And then you would carry on. All the rental cars vanished. I don't know if you remember that. There wasn't a rental car to be had. So
I had one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. They just vanished from America. Steve, I want to talk to you about normal things, because part of my deal is America is getting back to normal, even though 20 years later, we're leaving Afghanistan with our tail behind our legs and Americans trapped there. One of the things that will be normal this weekend is the NFL is back. In fact, it came back last night. Did you watch Brady and the Cowboys last night?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was. You know, you say get back to normal. I mean, how about that? You know, Brady still going at 44, another, you know, game-winning drive in the final minutes. Gronk back, fans back, great game. Hey, the Cowboys. Dak Prescott's back. There was a lot that kind of felt normal about that last
night.
Yeah,
408 yards for Prescott. A very exciting game. Are you doing NFL Sunday night this year, Steve?
Yeah, I think we're going to, you know, do what we did last year, which is kind of pick it up, I'd say probably after Thanksgiving, you know, with the playoff chase. So it's when it starts to come into focus and you're down to the final, you know, half dozen games or so, and every game really has pretty clear implications, I think we'll be, as we do road to 270 in politics, we'll do road to the playoffs in the NFL.
Well, aren't you doing at the start of the season odds on the Super Bowl, which I assume would put the Browns on the top of the board?
Well, I am. Not for the NBC coverage, but I'm actually going to be on the a little plug here on the Today Show, 9 a.m. hour this morning, and we're going to look at the playoff odds, the Super Bowl odds for different teams. Your Browns with a 71% chance of making the playoffs. Can you live with the pressure?
It should be closer to 100% because of the Ravens' injuries. I don't know if you've calculated that in. The Ravens,
yeah.
The poor guys. I hate the Ravens. I mean, really hate the Ravens. I hate the Steelers in a fun kind of way, but I really loathe the Ravens because they're my team. They took my team. Nevertheless, I don't wish what's happened to them on any club. I mean, three, four season-ending injuries.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I've ever seen anything like that, Steve.
At the same position, too, you know, running back just absolutely decimated. No, you're right. You know, Baltimore, I'm just looking at the numbers in front of me here. Their playoff odds sitting at 60% right now, 8% to make the Super Bowl, 4% to win it. Hey, the Browns, 15% to make the Super Bowl. It's going to be I think you got something to cheer for there in Cleveland. You know, I'm a Pats fan. I feel a lot better heading into 2021 than I did in 2020. And there are just some other great storylines out there too. Obviously, the transition down in New Orleans, Drew Brees, going away now in the broadcast booth, Jameis Winston taking over, some names from the past few years, getting another shot. So I just a ton of great storylines out there.
Oh, yeah. This is the first time since 99 that I did not fall for the hype too badly 2 years ago when OBJ showed up in Cleveland. But this is the first year I've fallen for the hype. I've told my boys we're going to L.A. for the Super Bowl, whatever it costs. But now, Steve, let's talk a little bit about the news. When I talked to our Washington Post reporter, Susanna George, in Kabul at the beginning of the show, she admits they have no idea how many Americans are there. And I am not impressed with the administration's efforts to articulate. And I was very down on Jen Psaki saying a handful. Do you have an informal number in your mind about how many Americans are still stranded, abandoned, held hostage, whatever word you want to use, in Afghanistan?
I don't, because it's one of those areas where, I'm at the mercy of all the news that you're talking about right there. And, so when I see the confusion that's kind of out there, that's where I am, too.
Okay. So last night, the president gave a speech. The reaction to it is very mixed along partisan lines. I am a big supporter of vaccines. I have been from the beginning. I can't wait to get my booster, which is about 2 weeks off for me because it's got to be 6 months after your second shot. I encourage everyone, please get vaccinated, because the numbers are true. About 95% of the people, actually greater than that, who are dying of the virus are unvaccinated. It is now a death toll of the unvaccinated. So please go and get vaccinated. That being said, I am a rule of law guy, and the president lacks the legal authority to mandate vaccines for employers with 100 or more people. He just does, unless there are federal government contractors or the federal government. Steve, do you expect that to be challenged? What have you heard about that? Because I expect there will be lawsuits brought today.
Yeah, every indication I've seen is there'll be some kind of challenge today. It seems like, anything that steps into those grounds gets challenged. I think with this administration, what we've seen in a couple other areas recently, you have to look at, what politics perhaps, are playing a role in here. And I think, and I suspect, and I get some indications talking to folks around the administration, their basic read on this is they think that they're on the right side of public opinion, with this. They think that there's broad support out there. And you can find, polling out there that when you ask the question about, companies mandating vaccines, employees being mandated to get a vaccine, the government mandating it for federal workers, that kind of thing, you do find pretty broad support in the polling on it. What I think is interesting, and I think this is true on so many other issues, when you ask the question a little bit differently, come at it from a slightly different angle, what I think it starts to reveal is there's probably more complexity to the public opinion on this one than we appreciate. And I think that complexity is probably going to be tested here with the steps Biden's taking. For instance, what I would say is, I was looking at a poll last night. I thought this was really striking. When you ask the question in the poll, should an employer mandate vaccines for employees, comes back 62% say yes. This is an Ipsos poll from 3 weeks ago. In the same poll, when you ask the question a little differently and you say, should an employee who refuses vaccination be fired, it comes back 38% yes, 62% no. When I say I think there's more complexity to public opinion on this, when I think it depends what precise angle you're coming at it from, that's what I mean. In the same poll, you can find, mass support for mandated vaccines by employers, and you can also find mass opposition to consequences for employees who refuse
vaccination. You're absolutely right. It is so hard to find a true evaluation tool. I'm just curious, Steve, if you've taken the New York Times test on the 6 political polls, because 4 members of my family have. We are all very closely bunched next to the growth and opportunity poll, but a little bit of variance. But they didn't ask any national security questions like, should defense spending be higher? Should America remain deployed around the world? Have you taken that test yet?
I did take it, although I was kind of unimpressed by it, to be honest with you, for some of the reasons you're saying. Some of the questions seemed odd, and the upper left quadrant had no label, and I think a quarter of the people landed in it.
Yeah, it's very weird. They need to go back and tweak it, but it's an interesting metric because America is in tribes. I just think there are more than 6 of them. Steve Kornacki will be watching you on the Today Show shortly. Follow him on Twitter @Steve Kornacki. I'll be right back. America, stay tuned. I want to remind you that our sponsor, is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I have one more clip to play from 20 years ago tomorrow. I was on live from 6 to 9 on the West Coast, 9 to noon on the East Coast during the attack on America. So the entire show is posted over at my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. So the last clip is I handed off the Salem Radio Network coverage of that terrible day to my friend Dennis Prager, cut number 32.
This is Hugh Hewitt, concluding the worst broadcast I've ever had to make, and I've made a lot of bad broadcasts. In the middle of the last election, Peggy Noonan wrote in the Wall Street Journal that the day would come when the terrible, big, bad thing would happen, and that she feared it would be soon, and for that reason she preferred President Bush over Vice President Gore. The terrible, big thing has now happened, and it will take some time for the enormity of it to settle in across the United States. So large is the scale of the devastation there. Joining me now is Dennis Prager, who will be taking over for me along many of these Salem Radio Network stations. Dennis, three of these four airplanes which were hijacked and crashed, headed for Los Angeles, the devastation that will seep out, sort of anticipated here. The big, horrible thing has happened.
Listen, I'm choosing my words carefully with you and my broadcast on many of the stations as you're on after you. A war has been declared against the United States, and war has been declared against the Western Judeo-Christian civilization. And I measure those words are measured. They're not new to me. I have believed that there is this war. When people scream in Iran, death to America, that America's the Satan, people take that stuff seriously. We laugh, but a lot of Americans just laugh at those slogans. But if enough people believe that America is Satan, then it is a very appropriate thing to murder as many men, women, and children who are satanic as possible.
As I have come to expect from you, Dennis, you've underscored something I hadn't thought of. There will be rejoicing around the world today in some quarters.
Of course, exactly.
There will be celebrations and parades.
That's right.
And cheering.
This is a national holiday in Tehran, in Sudan, among the Palestinians. Exactly. As the Japanese general, what did he say? We woke up a sleeping giant. We will regret it. That is what I think has happened today.
I agree with you. What do you do, Dennis? I have been on the air at times of tragedy before. There are always experts to talk to. I've talked to Frank Gaffney this morning. What are you going to do for 3 hours? I can talk to horrified people, and I'll tell you, the fury is building.
That's right.
In the emails and in the phone calls.
Well, it's in building in me. As I watched the Twin Towers this morning, I realized I was in delayed reaction. I had no reaction. I didn't understand what I was seeing. I was sure there was an error. You know, my psyche did not catch up with my eyes. And now my psyche is catching up with what my eyes saw. And the fury is a building. And an appropriate fury. I mean...
Well, Dennis, I will be listening with rapt attention. Good luck to you. It will
yes,
be a very
yes,
difficult
Hugh.
3 hours.
Yes, you did a good job, Hugh. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dennis Prager.
That was 20 years ago, America. Last night, or yesterday, 20 years after that terrible event, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, took to the podium in the White House and said this, cut number 3.
Thank you, Dennis. This morning, you noted that the current count is that there's about 100 Americans in Afghanistan. My colleague Susan Crabtree is hearing from sources with direct knowledge who say that it's about 143 U.S. citizens and then also permanent legal residents. there at the airport. Did the number that you were referring to this morning on Morning Joe, did that include permanent legal residents? Does the administration have a count of how many might be there? And then how hopeful are you that a lot of these folks are clustered there at the airport and can get out?
We do have counts, and the State Department is the best source to give accurate information about all of these numbers. And, of course, we account for legal permanent residents as well. The reason I said, and to give us a little bit more context to what I said, because I know that this feels confusing to people, not anyone in this room, but is that the number can range. I mean, one of the important pieces of context to understand is that even as we work to get American citizens, and we'll get you the number later this afternoon when it's confirmed out, there were individuals who didn't show up today for a range of reasons. We know that will happen. We will continue to remain engaged with these individuals about when they may need to leave. And there are days where people aren't ready to leave. That may change next week. So it's around 100. The State Department will have the most up-to-date numbers.
It is not around 100. We have no idea what it is. Susanna George, Washington Post bureau chief for Afghanistan and Pakistan, joined me this morning from Kabul. And there are people she knows who are afraid to call the State Department. There are people she knows who are frustrated with the State Department because the State Department's given inaccurate and incomplete information. We don't know. We don't know how many Americans. This is 20 years after 9/11. We got Americans held hostage in Afghanistan. 20 years after 9/11, we also have Jen Psaki, White House press secretary, saying this about the Taliban. 20 years after the attack on America, cut number four.
And then the Wall Street Journal, it's reporting that about 200 folks have been cleared by the Taliban. Just to clarify, are you saying that the Taliban is cooperating in getting Americans and Afghan allies out of Afghanistan right now?
Well, there was I don't know if it requires me saying that. It was in the statement, but we just had a plane land in Qatar. That is evidence that we are working with to coordinate to get American citizens, to get Afghan partners, and to get legal permanent residents out. And we're hopeful and working to ensure there are additional flights to Patsy's earlier question.
20 years after the attack on America, we're retreating from Afghanistan. We have been defeated in Afghanistan, and we're dependent upon the good graces of the Taliban. I'm joined now by Lonhee Chen, Stanford Institution scholar and now candidate for California Comptroller. Hello, Lonhee. What were you doing 20 years ago?
I was actually living in Washington, D.C., Hugh, and I remember vividly, actually, 9/11. And the attacks that day and, you know, being downtown trying to get – I was living in Bethesda at the time, actually, and trying to get from downtown D.C. back to Bethesda, which, you know, those of you who are listening who know, it's not that long of a drive. You know, usually probably takes about, I don't know, 25, 30 minutes. It took me about 4 hours that day.
And afraid the entire time that no doubt isolated from the news and not knowing what was happening around the world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think that was the hard part as well, is just the uncertainty of what was happening that day. But I can't believe it's been 20 years already, Hugh. I mean, it's remarkable.
Can you ever have imagined that in those 20 years we would have invaded Afghanistan, defeated the Taliban, and then been in turn defeated by the Taliban, retreated, and left Americans behind?
Well, what we've seen the last, you know, several weeks has been heartbreaking in my view. And to go through everything we've been through over the last 20 years, to go through all of the different ups and downs, all of the courageous people who have gone to Afghanistan to fight and to do the right thing there, and then to see how it's ended, really, that part to me is so tragic. And it seems to me, Hugh, it was avoidable, quite frankly. You know, all of what we've seen, the way in which it was executed, that to me is the most disappointing part of all of this. And, you know, history will still be written about this. There's a lot left to be said about it. I'm sure we'll dig into what happened. But from where I sit today, it sure feels like it's an awful empty feeling seeing what we've seen.
Now, Lonhee, you are running for controller in California. They have a recall election concluding next week. It's underway right now. I urge people to vote yes. I've endorsed Larry Elder in the second question. I'm afraid the YouTube Democrat is going to win if the Republicans scatter their votes around. I was originally going to stay on the sidelines because they're all good Republicans, but I don't want the YouTuber to win. What do you think has been the impact of this? And what do you think about Kamala Harris and Joe Biden campaigning in California in the middle of a hostage crisis in Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, I think the most important thing about this recall election, we've always known that this was going to be about turnout. It was going to be about which side was more animated and energized. And so it is crucially important, to your point, Hugh, if people in California have ballots and they have not returned them, have not voted them yet, they need to do so, and they need to make their voices heard. I think it's absolutely clear that Gavin Newsom has mishandled a number of things in the state of California. And that's why this recall election is happening in the first place. You had millions of Californians who were demanding his recall. And of those millions who initially demanded his recall, you know, there's been an effort by Democrats to frame this as a Republican recall. The reality is over 30% of people who submitted recall petitions in the first place were independents or Democrats. And so this is an effort that really is about Gavin Newsom's failed leadership. I do think that, of course, now you're seeing the politics come in, you know, all of these Democrats campaigning on behalf of Newsom. He's bringing in all these people because he recognizes he's in deep trouble. And that's the only reason why you've got Barack Obama cutting ads for Gavin Newsom, why Kamala Harris has come out, why Joe Biden may come out. It seems to me that Biden and Harris both should focus on the challenges they've got in front of them, and they are many of them, rather than traveling all the way to California to try and save a guy who, frankly, as I noted, his leadership has been troubled during this time.
Now, Lonnie, what is your website for people who want to get involved with sort of a progressive conservative, meaning a center-right conservative like I am? You're pro-vaccine, you're pro-getting the country back to work, you're pro-free enterprise and opportunity. What's the website?
People should visit chenforcalifornia.com, chenforcalifornia.com. I'm running for controller, which is the chief financial officer of the state of California. Lots of things that we can do to get the state in a better position fiscally, and that's really what I'm focused on, and that's why I'm running for this office. I think it starts, Hugh, with getting that part right, making sure that we're doing the basic blocking and tackling, helping people understand what does our state spend money on, how can we be more efficient, how can we do things better, how can we spend smarter, and that's why I'm running.
I think you could really help the homeless problem a great deal with some fiscal oversight. Let me close by asking, you're a very good lawyer, Lonnie. People don't know this. He teaches at Stanford Law School. He's at the Hoover Institution. I am very pro-vaccine. I want to urge everyone, please get vaccinated. You're at risk if you don't. But I am also a constitutional law professor, and I believe the president acted unconstitutionally last night in mandating businesses to mandate vaccines when those businesses have no connection to the federal government. What do you think, Lonnie?
I'm concerned about the executive overreach that we've seen. By the way, this is the problem we have with Gavin Newsom in California.
Yes.
It's the same problem we've had with the presidency as well, which is the overreach of executive power. And there are things that are meant for the legislative branch. There's a policies that are meant for Congress to pass and for the president to sign. And I think there's any number of different things that fall into that category. There's no question in my mind, Hugh, people should get vaccinated. I think it's a good thing to do. But at the end of the day, there are things that people can do because of their own free volition, and there are things that they have to do because government tells them. This is one of those situations where I am concerned about the use of executive power like you, Hugh.
Lonnie, good to talk to you. Thank you, my friend. Chen, C-H-E-N for California. Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. If you found yourself completely befuddled by events in Afghanistan, alarmed about inflation and otherwise uneasy, well, about everything, about Americans standing in the world, about what comes next, then you're feeling like everybody else is, and uncertainty is usually a time that you want to increase your holdings in gold. When I do that, I do it with Birch Gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. You can go to HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They will send you free information. If you want to roll over a portion of your IRA or your 401k into physical precious metals, Birch Gold is who to do that with. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of happy customers. If you're thinking, I got to get some gold, do it with Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh to 474747 or HughGold.com. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live today. Tomorrow's the 20th anniversary of 9/11. In the first hour, I played excerpts from my show, my live show 20 years ago when the attacks were underway. That is posted over at the interview with Hugh Hewitt, the entire show. I'll be on First Look later today after the Hillsdale Dialogue, but right now I'm joined by Hotline Josh, Josh Kroshauer with the National Journal. Follow him at Twitter at Hotline Josh. Good morning, Josh. You're a young man. Where were you 20 years ago tomorrow?
Yeah, I was starting my sophomore year in college, and I was actually home for the week, getting ready to go back to school in D.C. and watching the news that morning, just stunned, shocked for the country. It really was a change in my life. I remember whether it was politically and then the political environment, or just the you know, how we viewed national security. It was something that really just shaped my career and my final few years in college.
Were you at GW, Georgetown, American? Where were you going to school?
I was an American University graduate. So it was, my second year starting the year at AU.
And so that meant that as you saw those pictures, you saw people fleeing the White House, running north. They wouldn't quite have been able to sprint to AU, but they would have gotten there eventually. It's pretty traumatic for people who live in the city. I'm sure your mom and dad weren't too thrilled with the idea of you going back to D.C.
No, I didn't go back. I think, if I remember correctly, for a couple of days, school was closed. How did it shape me specifically? I mean, I remember being interested in taking almost every foreign policy class. I originally was a journalism major. I ended up becoming a history major. But, I remember being intensely interested in taking courses on the Middle East, national security, international affairs. That really shaped my worldview and frankly, my interest in politics and global affairs after that moment.
You know, time compresses history into paragraphs. And eventually the paragraph on America and Afghanistan will say a 20-year fruitless effort by America to root out Islamist fanaticism in Afghanistan ended in defeat and retreat in the fall. In the late summer and fall of 2021. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I remember being interested in politics, covering politics. You had pretty much the 2004 presidential election, a few years later, was one of the few that was defined by foreign policy and national security. And even into 2008, for a different reason. Even 20 years later, and it's surprising now that it's been quite some time, is a generation that doesn't remember those searing images live like I did and like we all did. But it is just such it's one of the most significant historical events, certainly in my own life.
In 2002, George Bush fought back against historical currents that typically cripple a first-term president, and he won. Seats in the United States Senate that year. His losses in the House were few, I believe. I think the opposite tide is going to flow against Joe Biden, that the defeat in Afghanistan will double the outcurrent. The tide's really going to go out on the Democrats next year because of the catastrophe felt in the fall of this year. What do you think, Josh?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a good political lesson is to do the right thing and the politics will fall. If you do the right thing, politics will fall as they may. And you know, as far as Biden goes, I think his administration got kind of sucked into these polls that showed widespread support for withdrawal from Afghanistan, but didn't really even think or game out the second order effects, the third order effects of what would happen if the Taliban takes over the country. What would happen with Al Qaeda? What would the public reaction be if the withdrawal goes chaotically and the military, you have military servicemen that are killed? The hubris of planning to celebrate as a mission accomplished moment the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan on 9/11, and now in reality seeing how it's the lowest point of his presidency with his job approval dipping into the low to mid 40 range. So yeah, but Bush was very much following his views on foreign policy. He was very much a guy by the gut, and he certainly there was a strong support initially for going to war in Iraq, certainly for the war in Afghanistan. But even when things went south, He surged the troops in Iraq when things went south, even though public opinion said otherwise. And it turns out that actually improved his political standing for a little bit at the end. So
in 2006, he gave a very famous speech in the library room in the basement after he got walloped, as he said. We got walloped or we got skunked. I can't remember what the term is. And then he fired Rumsfeld and brought in Robert Gates and sent Petraeus to do the surge because he doubled down and he won. And although he lost in 2008, it wasn't because of Afghanistan or Iraq. It was because of the economic collapse. I am curious, Josh, my view of last night's speech is that it was a cynical attempt to turn attention away from the collapse in Afghanistan and an unconstitutional overreach. What do you think?
You know, what I will say is that Biden's political standing on the pandemic has been dropping almost as much as his handling of Afghanistan, which is even lower. But Biden's political strength for the first 6 months of his presidency was the belief that things were getting better with the pandemic. Things were the light was at the end of the tunnel, and we were just about there. That July 4th speech, that hasn't been the case lately. So I think he did need a sort of a political reset on where he stands on the pandemic. I'm a little, for his political fortunes, I'm a little skeptical if this is going to work. I think when you have such an overarching mandate that you know, I think they had a political edge in terms of criticizing anti-vaccine Republicans. Now, when you're threatening someone's jobs or livelihoods if they don't get the vaccine, it puts them in a more challenging political space. I'm not sure if this is a political winner.
And an unconstitutional space. Josh Crossour, Hotline Josh on Twitter. Thank you, Josh. The Hillsdale Dialogue is next, America. More Lincoln with Larry Oren. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Friday Edition show.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.